Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning, Ramona Cobal here for The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today, American novelist, essayist and non-fiction writer Nicholson Baker on an intellectual journey that took him from collecting old newspapers at risk of destruction by library archivists, no less, to reading through them in his barn, and to writing a dramatic analysis of how the taste for war, the armaments industry, racism, seemed to make the Second World War sadly inevitable, a fascinating and revealing book. And we're continuing our first-person reading of Christopher Kremer's book, The Carpet Wars. Yesterday's news is really only good to wrap up fish and chips with. That's the way it's seen in the media business. But Nicholson Baker thinks otherwise and proves it in his new book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. Nicholson Baker is a writer of fiction, fiction in which he pays attention to the small details in his characters' lives. For example, his first novel, The Mezzanine, follows the thoughts of a man going to buy shoelaces and riding an escalator. Room Temperature was about a father feeding his six-month-old daughter. Vox is a transcribed phone sex conversation. He said that he wanted his books to be about things you don't notice when you're noticing them. This new book, though, is about a very big thing, the end of civilization, no less, but I suspect that the very mindset that one might call obsessive attention to detail that drives one part of his writing might well have led to this very important and compelling book. Nicholson Baker joins us from a studio in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, near his home. Welcome to The Book Show, Nicholson.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Ramona. Thank you.
Well, I guess, there's so much I can... Where do I start? I guess a good thing to do would be to describe this book. So it's a series of sort of short little pieces, like vignettes, I suppose, ranging from August 1892 to December 31st, 1941. Mm. You say it was something, you know. It was here or it was there or... you describe something happened, whether it's in Poland or it's in New York or something that Churchill was doing or something that Eleanor Roosevelt was saying, and you don't editorialise at all. There's not much of a voice of Nicholson Baker here, save, obviously, the selections. What was the idea behind how you put this book together?
Well, I wanted to create the sense of a war that it wasn't yet a war. A war is composed of many, many individual decisions to do something heroic, to do something horrifying, to avoid something, to talk to someone. And each one of those decisions happened at some point on some day. So I wanted to rescue the idea that the truth of this massive catastrophe that we now call the Second World War was very granular at the time. It was something that people lived through day to day.
And I think one of the reviews I read said, you know, people were angry with Nicholson Baker because he was criticizing their favorite war.
Oh, yes. Well, it is a war that now has a kind of lacquered surface. It's very difficult to get at the uncomfortable things that happened because it's so important to everyone that this was the good and necessary and defensible war. And I think it's time to allow that surface to crack a little bit and to look at what's in there.
Well, what's in there? I mean, I'm going to talk to you about, you know, how this book evolved and where it came from, but let's talk about what I didn't know about. Now, I'm not an educated person in history. But I've read a lot of books, and I'm probably subject to a lot of the received wisdom about history, right? I didn't know, for example, until I read your book, how, you know, people like Roosevelt and his wife and Churchill were really anti-Semitic. And there's evidence of that in what they said and what they wrote. And they weren't ashamed of it, were they?
Well, and it's important to say that the kind of civilized, shall we say, anti-Semitism that was part of Roosevelt's circle, and that you can see in some of Churchill's statements when he was really a fanatical anti-Bolshevist in the 20s, is very different from the kind of state-supported, the terrifying anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany, which was a lower class kind of skinhead movement of kids. So it's a very different thing, and yet the two, unfortunately, participated in together in creating the disastrous feeling or state of being trapped that the Jews were in.
I didn't know that Churchill hated Gandhi with a passion, and in fact killed Indians in the lead up to the war.
Well, and I think that one of the discoveries for me in writing the book was how much the British response to German aggression was conditioned by the way that they approached the entire British Empire. They had something called air control. They wanted to make people do what the British Empire needed them to do by dropping explosives on them. And this was the way they responded to events really all over. So when the Germans then became the enemy, even more so than Gandhi, because it was for a while there, I think Churchill hated Gandhi really more than anyone else. But then Hitler became the primary enemy. When that happened, they simply used the techniques of air control, or tried to use them, on German cities.
Yeah, I mean, and even our own Prime Minister, Robert Menzies, gets a Guernsey in this book. And I'll talk to you about how you got to be acquainted with Robert Menzies. But Robert Menzies has a view of Winston Churchill, and where he visits in 1941, on March the 1st, 1941, and he says that Churchill talked about U-boats. The light of battle was in his eyes. Menzies wrote, "In every conversation, he ultimately reaches a point where he positively enjoys the war." And he says, "Churchill." You say Churchill was growing on him. Menzies wrote, "The man had an astonishing grasp of detail. Quote, his real tyrant is the glittering phrase, so attractive to his mind that awkward facts may have to give way."
Oh, well, Robert Menzies is one of the... When I discovered his diary, I was so delighted, because he was an outsider in London, and he was meeting all these people for the first time and was fascinated by him, and he was a funny, intelligent man, so a great observer. So he was very important to me in giving a view of Churchill that was, I think, more accurate than most. When but he you, said that...
Sorry, go on. I just wanted to tell you that he was in love with the English, and you know, he was an Anglophile of the greatest order.
And he was tremendously admiring by the end of Churchill. And one doesn't want to diminish Churchill in an unfair way. The man is brilliant. He is a master of phrase making. He's a great speechwriter. He's a great historian. And he wrote the history of both wars after he fought him. He was primarily, when he was in the First World War and the Second World War, he was first and foremost a warrior, a kind of old-fashioned British Empire scrapper. And that's the Churchill that I think we want to recapture in telling this part of the story.
Somebody else's view of Churchill, is it John Gunther's bestseller Inside Europe, published by Harper and Row, in 1940 War Edition. They had a section on Winston Churchill. And Gunther wrote, "For years, not now, it seemed that he stood always on the wrong side of great social issues. He'd opposed the vote for women, he'd opposed the mild socialism of the Labour Party, he'd opposed a democratic government in India, and he had invaded Russia in 1919 to save it from Bolshevism. When he was a boy, he'd had 1,500 toy soldiers. Once he jumped off a bridge and spent months recovering. Sometimes when one inspects his leading political ideas," Gunther says, "one feels that they are the ideas of an incredibly talented, willful, badly educated child."
And there's something of truth in that. But it's, of course, all the voices in this book are voices that the reader has to evaluate. I don't say listen to this person and don't listen to this person, because I wanted to live through this time in a way, to suffer through this time in it, in all of its fragmented, shrapneled reality, the way somebody lived through it then. They would read John Gunther's book and they would say, well, yeah, that's true of Churchill, but on the other hand, listen to him on the radio. I've been roused to action. This is a brilliant orator. But he was a man who whose first reaction in both the First World War and the Second World War was the idea of starving Germany into submission. And that is a huge decision with many, many consequences.
Of course, Hitler's intentions were clear in the early 30s. I mean, it was clear that what he wanted to do with the Jews, and it mm-hmm. was clear about, you know, his ambitions for the country. And of course, you know, as we know, he's no angel. Is it Breiting writes a summary of Hitler, saying Hitler exerts over his staff semi-hypnotic influence. I was told he sometimes rages around the Brown House like a madman. He was, Breiting thought, a neurasthenic, a man of enormous egotism with a tendency towards megalomania. Sometimes, it was said, he burst into tears. He left a strong impression. In any case, his chin under the centrepiece of the moustache showed great energy. And the quote is, as he speaks, he frequently grimaces as if he would like to crush his opponent with his teeth. These are very kind of novelistic descriptions, aren't they?
They are, there's absolutely nothing to be gained by saying the Second World War, that there was this terrible man, Hitler, who fantasized from the beginning about the eradication of the Jews, who's the central source of this evil that beset Europe, and to take that reality and replace it with a reality that says no. Churchill was just as bad. That is a mistake. That's the idea of some sort of moral equivalence between the two. And what I wanted to do in this book was avoid any implication like that and to say history is not made up of these two countries that are on a seesaw, but of many individual actions, some of them heroic and some of them mistaken. And each one of them we have to look at in a sense, almost out of context, as something someone did on a particular day, rather than using them as in some kind of algebraic equation, saying, well, Germany was bad and therefore England was good or something like that.
No. I mean, I think that's the mistake that a lot of the critics of this book have fallen into, that trap. I mean, that's not what you're doing and that's not what you're saying. But the US wanted war with Japan very early. I think somebody mentions this in the early 30s, I think 34 or something. So, you know, the Pearl Harbor story doesn't start the war with Japan.
Well, the thing about Japan that was so interesting to me was that the American aircraft salesmen were there in China watching the Japanese bombing of cities, and then they would say, well, this is really an opportunity for us. And then they got the State Department involved. And, of course, the United States was in a depression, and the American aircraft companies were not selling their airplanes to the American government, so they were looking for ways to sell them, and they sold them all over the world, including to Germany and Japan and China.
And so did the French and English arms manufacturers.
Yes, and the lead up to the war is a lead up of arms sales to all the people who then became our enemies, and there were articulate people at the time saying this arming of the entire world isn't a good idea. And the interesting thing about the people who were speaking most forcefully about the idea that the West should not be building huge fleets of boats and airplanes were also the people who were saying open the borders. There are Jews suffering who want to leave. The people who were most pacifistic were also the ones who were most interested in alerting the world to the plight of those who were actually suffering.
So we're talking about Quakers and other pacifists.
There was something called the Fellowship of Reconciliation. There was the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, I think it was called. There were all these groups who in some ways were powerless and had very little direct effect on history, but whose voices are important to listen to, because they were, although they weren't in power, they often were speaking things that were both realistic and morally subtle.
and going to visit Germany, you know, going to visit the Nazis and trying to sort of argue for an open door policy to allow the Jews to leave, you know, in a kind of innocence, really, a sad innocence.
Yes, I think that's one of the powerful things about some of these voices, these pacifists, you call them. I mean, the word almost makes you wince because the word pacifist doesn't sound good anymore. But they had to be willing to look foolish. And after Kristallnacht, which was hundreds of synagogues burned to the ground and an enormous state-organized violence against Jews in 1938, the Quakers said, what do we do? And three of them, including the 75-year-old man Rufus Jones, who was sort of the head of the Quaker Church, although there's no titular head, but the informal head, went over in order to find out what they could do to help the suffering of the Jews. And they met actually with Heydrich's representatives and said, and it was an enormously risky and brave act that kind of raises the hairs on the back of your neck when you read about it.
Mm. On the book show, I'm speaking with Nicholson Baker, author of Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II and the End of Civilization. And you're on the book show with Ramona Koval. And, well, you know, I didn't know that the Italians were bombing the Ethiopians with gas. And, you know, everyone was just basically arming up, weren't they? Tooling up.
I suppose that's true. That you could make the argument that there's a kind of inevitability, that there's a huge locomotive of war that just gets going and that it's impossible to stop. I think, though, that there were points in which negotiation and an armistice would have saved lives. I don't say that in the book, but I want the possibility of that the reader will come to a certain point in, say, 1940 and say, wait a second, I think here, if this had gone differently, possibly something would have worked out that would have led to a Europe that would have not have had the kind of years of carnage that it did have, the destruction. So.
The writer Stefan Zweig, who was a Viennese Jew, I actually just read his Beware of Pity over the summer. He forms a kind of backbone to this book. He comes starts and towards the end as well. And what's he doing there? What purpose does he serve in the book?
Well, first of all, he was one of the discoveries I made. I mean, one of the things you want to do as a historian, an amateur historian, because I'm not a professional, but is to find the people to love. You want to find people that you admire and love and you think of as heroes. You need those kind of people. And the heroes that I found were Victor Klemperer, a diarist who lived in Dresden. He was a Jew who was struggling, trying to figure out what to write about while his country went insane. And there was Stefan Zweig, who became a pacifist after the First World War and continued to be a pacifist until he committed suicide shortly after Pearl Harbor. And
But he was in Brazil when he committed suicide, wasn't he?
Well, because the people who had some standing, he was probably the best-selling German writer of his time, really, or one of them, were able to escape. If you had credentials, if you were famous, you could get out of Germany because you could get a visa. It was the people who were poor, who were not famous, who had no standing, who were trapped. So he had ended up in Brazil, but his attitude to Pearl Harbor was that the extension of the war into the Pacific was the greatest catastrophe ever, and that this was going to cause a very long war. And he was right, a very long war. And he said his hand trembled over the page. And I wanted to remind people that the pacifist movement before the Second World War was thought to be and was truly was a Jewish movement. It was and when there would be these kind of veiled anti-Semitic remarks about pacifists and communists and things, it was because the Jews rightly saw that the violence of the First World War was a horrific thing. So I wanted to recapture that, the essential thread of Jewish pacifism.
Hermann Göring, the second in command in the Nazi Party, appeared at a reception for the diplomatic corps. You write, he wore green boots and held a six-foot spear. And I'm going to read this. Göring was a morphine addict. He was rich and corpulent. He changed his clothes several times a day. In the morning, he would wear perhaps something with short, puffy white sleeves. At dinner, a violet kimono with fur-trimmed bedroom slippers. Once he reclined on an ottoman with his pant legs pulled up, showing cardinal red silk stockings. At hunting parties, he was accompanied by beaters and dog leaders carrying boar spears, whose flashing tips were protected by tasseled leather sheaths. And then in August 22, 1939, Hitler invites his military commanders to his house in the mountains. Göring, the master of ceremonies, was wearing short pants, lace-up boots, a strap-on dagger in a red sheath, and a green jacket with yellow leather buttons. What on earth is going on with these people? I mean, honestly, you know, he sounds sort of like a large garden gnome. And Hitler bursting into tears and all of this, you know, carry on. It sounds like carry on up the wherever, up the wolf house. I mean, you must have smiled when you found this. Where's this from?
Well, that's from actually that description of Göring's outfit is from a secondary source, a very good book on the beginnings of the Second World War by a man named Watt. Göring was a really fascinating figure. I think a man really in love with Hitler, as a number of top.
And Goebbels loved him too. I mean, Goebbels said, "Oh, Hitler invited me to a party, and I think he's fantastic."
Yes, and it's hard to recover the appeal of Hitler at this point because he's obviously just completely detestable. But he did exert a tremendous fascination over, and against that kind of that bizarre kind of fin de siècle Nazi ceremoniousness, you have to put someone like Christopher Isherwood, who was looking at all of this, saying, "I just can't be in England when it ramps up for war. I have to escape." And he went to Hollywood, and he said, even the pacifists weren't working for him, because he said the pacifists were sort of militant in their pacifism, and they feared the plain moral stand against killing. And so he ended up trying to become a Quaker. So there are all different ways of responding to this time, and I wanted there to be a kind of constellation in the reader's mind of different ways of looking at it.
All right, well, let's now talk about how you begin this project. You'd been working on a book-length history of the Library of Congress. Why were you doing that?
I was writing a history of the Library of Congress because there's a secret history to the Library of Congress that involves military intelligence, and I wanted to tell that story. And the story begins in the Second World War, and then I realized that I needed to apprentice myself to the Second World War and really understand it in a feeling kind of way. And so that's when I began working my way through that and put aside the more particular history of the Library of Congress.
Now, did this lead you, or were you already involved in saving newspaper archives?
All this was happening about the same time. My wife and I had a large collection of newspapers that happened to come from London, in a rented space.
From the British Library, wasn't it?
Yes, and they were all in a space in a big mill building in a town called Rollinsford, New Hampshire. And I would look through these newspapers and look at the headlines from 1940 and 1941. And so I knew my way around a newspaper, I thought. maybe better than some, and I knew that there were things that were really hiding in plain sight that had been lost to the story of the Second World War, because historians are so interested, rightly so, in all the secret archives and the diplomatic back channels. But what people actually read on the front page of the newspapers sometimes, it has more vividness and truth in it, despite all the distortions that newspaper writing is prone to, than the things that. And also, you have to remember that the people like Churchill and Roosevelt, everyone, started their day by reading the newspaper. So unless you read it, you don't know what they're thinking about that day.
So let's just ratchet it back a bit. You're with all these newspapers in your mill house because you decided, you'd heard that the British Library was getting rid of its newspaper collections, of foreign newspaper collections, and the New York Times and some of the other, the New York World were part of it, the Forward, the Yiddish newspaper from New York. And you decided, because you had a passion for newspapers and you couldn't understand why people would want to throw them away.
Well, the thing to remember is that newspapers are exceptionally rare. The New York Times itself has no complete run of its own newspaper, and these things are rarer than Gutenberg Bibles and things. They're the rarest of rare books, and so I felt that it was worth starting a nonprofit and saving these things rather than have them be cut up as newspapers of the day you were born, which is what usually happens to them, and that's how we ended up having them. But once we had them, then the revelation was that they were so interesting. They were full of color. Often they were just beautiful things, you know. And so the fact that they were also important documents, historical sources, and all that, took a backseat to the idea that they were just incredibly rich and fun to leaf through. And that's what I did for several years, until finally the entire collection went as a gift to Duke University.
Yeah, and I can imagine you sitting in this mill house at Nicholson Baker, making notes. Oh, look at this. This is what happened. What happened with war with Japan, and this is a report of the Italians bombing Ethiopians, and then you thought, well, maybe this is a book. Is that what you thought?
I thought that it was shocking how much of the bombing war was really there. Everybody who read even just the front page of a newspaper knew what the British were doing over Germany. And what they were doing was really savage. I mean, there's a moment where the New York Times front page, one of the sub-headlines is, "Woods are bombed." And this is very early in the war. The decision was made by Churchill and the Air Ministry to try to set fire to the Black Forest and really all the forests of Europe, using these particular kinds of wafers that would set fire to the forest when they dried. They were released from the airplane wet, and they would dry in the sunlight and then catch fire. This is an amazing thing to be in a newspaper, and it changes your feeling about what where were the hesitations about this, and where was the thought that this would be the right response to German aggression?
So. And, you know, it just makes you value newspapers of record and the way, you know, proper journalism should be done, and people should be sent to far-flung places and report in detail. And you know, who knows what's going to be made of it in another 50 years, but it needs to be done. But I also wanted we don't have enough time to talk to you, Nicholson Baker, but I wanted also to talk to you about Wikipedia, because it's not as if you're just obsessed with old newspapers. You have written a fantastic piece in the New York Review of Books a couple of months ago on Wikipedia. Wikipedia, you say, is just an incredible thing. It's It's fact-encirclingly huge, and it's idiosyncratic, careful, messy, funny, shocking, and full of simmering controversies, and it's free, and it's fast. You love Wikipedia, and partly because it is a huge sort of democratic tool, with a whole lot of people combing it and making things correct, and other people vandalising it in funny kind of ways. And is it true that your mother got involved with your Wikipedia entry?
She did. She. I didn't. I don't read the entries about my own books or myself on Wikipedia because it's as if I'm eavesdropping on something that I shouldn't be hearing. But I guess my mother saw that it's an inaccuracy in the piece about me, and so then edited it. Said, "Can't we fix this?" Which, and I guess it was fixed. And that's the miracle.
But
of
tell
Wikipedia.
Me what. Tell us what the bit was that she was concerned about.
Well, I think it just said that I was born in Rochester, New York, or born in. I think it was the place I was born.
It was the place you were born.
And she said, you know, I'm his mother, and I should know.
And I was there.
Yeah.
So your mother got involved. That's good. But tell me about your involvement with Wikipedia, because you're a bit of a Wikipedia obsessive about certain things, aren't you?
Well, in the course of writing this review, I felt that one of the things you've got to do if you're writing about Wikipedia is actually see what it's like to edit articles. And the thing about editing articles on Wikipedia is that it's tremendously addictive because you are suddenly you go through the mirror and you're in the world of an encyclopedia, and the words are just malleable. You can do anything. And of course, if you're a vandal, you can do something destructive. But if you're somebody who wants to tell a truth, you can correct something, you can expand something, you can change the order of the thing. It's a tremendous feeling of, I don't know what, it's difficult to describe the sense of strange power that you have to help write an encyclopedia entry, knowing that other people are going to correct your mistakes and that you're part of this gigantic group effort. It's a very heady thing. So I loved it. Loved it to the point where I really, for several weeks, I was just completely caught up in it. I'm clean and sober now for a week or two.
But you've actually written a few Wikipedia articles yourself. What have you written about?
I wrote an article about the Cosmopolitan Club, which is a women's club in New York. And I've fixed up articles. What I found was important was to save articles from deletion, because Wikipedia, one of the great strengths is it is so miscellaneous. It's so full of things that you didn't know would be there. And I would find someone would propose some fascinating small article for deletion, and I would immediately have to leap into motion, scan the Nexus database, find more substantiating reasons why this person or thing or event was notable. And once you bulk up the article and make it bristle with citations, it becomes harder to delete. So that became my mission on Wikipedia for that period.
Tell us about some of these vandals, though. They can be pretty funny, can't they?
Oh, I think they're having a great time. And the thing is, Wikipedia needs these vandals because that's what gives this. It is not just the most useful encyclopedia ever made. It's really it's a massive multiplayer game in which you have the bad guys who are in replacing the aardvark article with an aardvark is a medium-sized inflatable banana, you know, or something like that.
Yes.
And then you have those people, and then you have the good guys who leap in minutes later and restore the article, and it's so much more fun than writing an encyclopedia. It's writing an encyclopedia with bad guys lurking behind the bushes.
And look, you say the Pop-Tarts page is often a flutter. Pop-Tarts, as it says as of today, this is February the 8th this year, were discontinued in Australia in 2005. You say maybe that's true. Before that it said Pop-Tarts were discontinued in Korea. Several days ago it said Pop-Tarts is German for little iced pastry, oh Germany. Other things I learned from earlier versions, more than 2 trillion Pop-Tarts are sold each year. George Washington invented them. They were developed in the early 1960s in China. Popular flavours are frosted strawberry, frosted brown sugar, cinnamon and semen. Somebody says, once last fall, the whole page was replaced with nipples and broccoli.
Yes, there's some really inspired vandals, and you shouldn't even call that vandalism. It's a form of
haiku.
Culture. Yeah. But then again, it shouldn't be there forever, and that's the thing. So Wikipedia needs the vandals, but the vandals need Wikipedia to be an orderly place, or the replacement of a page with nipples and broccoli isn't funny.
Yeah, I know. But still, this is, though, the article on Archimedes with this. This is the whole replacement of the article on Archimedes. It's been replaced with this. Archimedes is dead. He died. Other people will also die. All hail chickens. The Power Rangers say hi. The end.
Yeah, there's some.
Laugh.
No, we shouldn't. It's very serious. But they're brilliant, brilliant people who are doing work that lasts sometimes minutes, sometimes less than a minute, because they're all these very efficient bots. That, you know, is automatic software that comes in and detects that a whole page has been replaced by one phrase, and then looks for obscenities and says, ah, that is vandalism, and then replaces the page. So it's an amazing thing.
It's amazing that you actually say the first thing you did on Wikipedia was to make some not very good edits to the page on bovine somatotropin. Now, what was your interest?
Well, I've been wanting to write a piece on bovine growth hormones, and so I happened to know a few things about it, and I thought I could contribute. I thought the idea was to contribute to the things that you know about. And that's true to an extent. But what you really need to do is stay away from the things that you care desperately about, because you're likely to be, your judgment is impaired about
those things. A bit in love,
yeah.
and not detached enough. Well, look, it's been fantastic speaking with you, Nicholson Baker. I'm sorry we can't go on. But
it's been a great pleasure.
But time, you know, the clock and everything. Although you have stopped the clock in some of your work, but we can't do it now on the radio live. The book is called Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And Nicholson Baker, it's been great speaking with you today.
Been a real pleasure. Thank you.
On tomorrow's book show, Sir Peter Stoddart, editor of the Times Literary Supplement, joins me for a conversation about that most English of composers, Sir Edward Elgar, and another prominent English figure, the rather embattled Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, that's a hard thing to say, as well as the Nobel Prize-winning Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk. So we'll talk about all of them with him. And in Brock Clark's novel, An Arsonist's Guide to Writers' Homes in New England, writers' homes go up in smoke at an alarming rate. He doesn't have anything against writers, but he does question the way we mythologise novelists and the way we revere stories, even though some can hurt us. That's on the book show tomorrow. Remember, you can hear this program with Nicholson Baker again, and I think I will too, because I liked him, tonight at midnight, or by going to the website abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Have a fantastic day. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.